Okay, appeal number 061613, United States versus Scott Serfling.
Yes, Your Honor. This is essentially an appeal from a judgment in a criminal case where we assert that Mr. Serfling did not get a fair trial. We also assert that the sentencing was inappropriate. The first ground is for a Brady violation, we believe. Prior to the trial, a motion was made with respect to certain documents from Fifth Third Bank. There were two banks involved in this loan process. Fifth Third Bank, which had a loan on the property, and Awula, which was granting a loan. Before the trial, we made a motion with respect to documents related to Fifth Third Bank, because the theory essentially was that Fifth Third Bank and a woman by the name of Capri were really the architects of this fraud.
You know, Mr. Hart, as I understand it, your defense theory at trial was that Mr. Serfling had no knowledge of the fraud being perpetrated around him. But that theory certainly wouldn't explain why he thought he could use $200,000 in loan proceeds to pay off personal debts. And even if evidence of Fifth Third's alleged malfeasance was improperly held back by the government, which, to be perfectly frank, I for one don't see it. Couldn't the jury have found Mr. Serfling guilty based on his acts that had nothing to do with Fifth Third's actions, like using loan money specifically earmarked for construction purposes to pay off personal debts?
Your Honor, the $200,000 with respect to the closing was, I don't believe, to essentially pay off debts. But the real issue in the case was the $12 million loan from Awula and the $10 million of Fifth Third Bank that went to pay off the debt. The question, I mean, the theory was that of defense was this was not Sperling, it was Fifth Third Bank and Ms. Capri. The first ground with respect to the Brady violation is that we made a motion to produce documents with respect to Fifth Third Bank explicitly. And the response is that the government had about 10,000 documents which it related were irrelevant. Now, that gave one that there was nothing related to the specific request of Fifth Third Bank involved in this deal, where the document ultimately at sentencing related to a hideous loss that Fifth Third Bank was suffering. But where they said it was these documents were irrelevant meant a message that they had been reviewed. And this document that they used at sentencing was explicit and would have been a very significant document in the trial of the case with respect to Fifth Third Bank, because Fifth Third Bank felt it was going to have a hideous loss unless this Awula loan didn't go ahead. It was a rather complicated case, but I say to you that Fifth Third Bank came on strong to have the deal consummated by the end of March 2002. This document would have been very significant in the trial. I tried the case. The theory was it was Fifth Third Bank and Capri.
But the documents were made available to you, and no effort was made to review them. So in what sense was there suppression?
Your Honor, of course, Brady says intentional or unintentional. The point is we trusted the government when they said there was nothing relevant in these documents. So we were getting ready for the rest of the case.
So the government's deeming the documents for its own purposes to be irrelevant constitutes suppression? That's a novel suggestion.
Well, there is no case specifically on this that we could find. But where you say to the defendant who explicitly says it wants such documents, that we've reviewed the documents and there's nothing relevant, where it is relevant, and then they use it in the sentencing. I mean, it's just wrong to do that. And they shouldn't be allowed to do that. And consequently, we believe that there was a Brady violation and it was significant. The second ground is where we had a motion in limine with respect to gambling on the part of Cerflin. It was granted. Notwithstanding that, they brought in Deborah Colson, a witness, who was a collector for Rampart Casino, and went to the testimony that she said that Cerflin came in and got $4,600 to pay for markers. Now, that brought on a motion, of course, and the court sustained the motion, but the jury had the information, which we were seeking to exclude, that there was anything like that in the case. It was wrong to do that.
There was a curative instruction delivered a couple of times immediately after the objection was sustained and later in the closing instructions.
But you get up and object to this. It's before the jury. You have a sidebar. The court then sustains the objection and instructs the jury. But I only say to you that experience delivers the fact that the jury has the information, significant information, that this man is a gambler. And he used the money, all this money, with respect to gambling. That's just wrong. And it's explicitly against the instruction of the judge. And if it was, it was wrong initially. They shouldn't have brought it out. But this was a motion in limine before the trial. Not to do this. Did it anyway. That isn't appropriate. That's unfair. We complain about the banking expert's testimony, Sarsfield not being included. That testimony was to identify the procedures that you would expect with respect to Fifth Third that should have taken steps.
But how do you respond to the argument that no matter how incompetent Wulo or the Fifth Third Bank was, this, you know, we've held over and over that defendants in fraud cases cannot defend themselves by blaming the victim?
Your Honor, it isn't so much that we're complaining of the victim. This was Fifth Third Bank, which was pushing to get this loan done by the end of March 2002, and the banking expert would have given us the ability to say, look, banks just don't act this way except for a purpose. The purpose was to get the money to get away from this idiot's loan. And that at least we could argue that with Sarsfield's testimony that the banking procedure would have been contrary and that Fifth Third Bank did this. And it was Sperling who was harmed. And on the sentencing, we complain about the fact that he was given 78 months and that an 18 was given with respect to the extent of the loan. The loan from Rula was $11.75 million. That went to Fifth Third Bank in the main. And then Rula in 2004, after this indictment came forward, sold the Gurney property for $5 million. And so the victim, it is asserted, suffered $6.75 million 2 years after this occurred and after the indictment. That, we suggest to you, was inappropriate under the circumstances in the sentencing. We also say that the government, in its case, put on evidence that the property was worth $11.5 million. Wula got the property, which was worth $11.5 million, but sold it 2 years later for $5 million. And it's not proper to assess that against the surfling. We also suggest to you that the $1 million they suggest surfling got was inappropriate, and it raised the sentencing by a multiplier of two. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal if I can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Hart. Okay. Ms. Jenkins, good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Lindsay Jenkins and I represent the United States. I'd like to begin with the first claim that counsel addressed, specifically the Brady claim. The government's position is that this particular claim fails because Serfling cannot establish any of the three elements necessary to survive a Brady claim. First, the document in this case, which is the March 12, 2002 memorandum authored by Fifth Third Bank, was disclosed to the defense in an August 22, 2005 letter, and again in a September 8, 2005 letter. The government made Serfling aware of the fact that it had just received approximately 10,000 pages of documents from a civil litigation between Fifth Third Bank and the original owner of the property, Martin Tuohy, and that it did not think any of those documents were relevant for trial purposes. But most importantly, Mr. Serfling was more than welcome to come at any time and review those documents. That disclosure was made about a month before the trial, which the government's position is that was sufficient time for him to have made use of those documents at trial. Significantly, the letters were specific as to the contents of the boxes. The letters were very specific in stating that they related to this civil litigation as opposed to some general characterization as to what the documents were. It was very specific as to what the contents of the boxes were. It's also noteworthy that the government didn't believe them to be relevant for trial and didn't use a single document at trial at all in its case. And, of course, through the exercise of reasonable diligence, if the defense had actually reviewed the contents of the boxes, they could have discovered whatever it is that they'd like to use within the boxes, specifically the March 12, 2002 memorandum. Also noteworthy is the fact that if the defense felt that there was not enough time from the August 22, 2005 disclosure, they were certainly welcome to seek a continuance to have additional time to review the contents of the boxes should they have chosen. And in addition, the documents were subpoenaed from a civil litigation, and they had every opportunity to have subpoenaed those documents on their own and receive them on their own. The second element of a Brady claim is that the document in this case was not exculpatory. It did not exclude the defendant, Scott Serfling, as a participant in the scheme. And relatedly, that falls under the third prong, which is that there was no prejudice in this case. Government's position is that any mention of Fifth Third Bank wanting to avoid a hideous loss was cumulative of other evidence presented at trial. several of the witnesses that were called to the stand were either cross-examined or examined on direct examination as to whether or not Fifth Third Bank stood to gain from the $11.75 million loan that Western United was going to issue. And that theory, in short, was pounded out throughout the trial. It was the defense's theme, and the jury rejected it, at least to the extent that they found that Scott Serfling was involved.
You argued that Fifth Third Bank's desire to solve the loan would not preclude Serfling from devising and executing his own fraud scheme, and that's true enough. But doesn't it at least lend some support, however small, for Serfling's defense theory that Fifth Third Bank and its employees were perpetrating a fraud and Serfling got caught up in the middle of it?
I think the document in and of itself certainly does lend some support to his theory that Fifth Third Bank knew what was going on, or more importantly, that it knew the loan was going forward and it did nothing to stop it. But I think that the government's position is that Serfling certainly put on evidence at trial from which he would have wanted the jury to conclude that he didn't know what was going on and that it was really Fifth Third Bank that was involved in the fraud. And I would just take this opportunity to point out some of the facts that overwhelmingly establish that Mr. Serfling knew exactly what was going on, the first of which is that he received $200,000 in cash into a personal bank account, which at the time had less than $6 in it before that deposit was made. That money was then spent on personal debts, including repaying friends and repaying other debts that he had to other people. In fact, in this case, the evidence showed that Mr. Serfling actually obtained a copy of this Ford lease, the terminated but true Ford lease, doctored it, and faxed it to the appraiser in December of 2001. And he made several attempts to receive at least $620,000 in loan proceeds at the time of the closing, which was rejected at that time.
Well, in the section of your brief that discusses the two-level enhancement for deriving more than $1 million from the fraud scheme, the government simultaneously asserted on page 42 that Serfling obtained control of the property, and then on page 44 that Serfling never owned the property. Is there a distinction you were trying to make there?
I think what we're referring to there is that prior to the Western United loan closing, he did not own that property prior to the deal closing in late March, early April of 2002. Essentially, one of Mr. Serfling's argument at sentencing was that he previously had an ownership interest in the property before it closed, and therefore he should not be subject to a two-level enhancement for receiving in excess of $1 million because he had owned the property before. He had an ownership interest in the property before. The government's position is that's just simply not bared out by the facts, that none of the witnesses ever testified that Mr. Serfling had an ownership interest in the property prior to the March 2002 closing. To the extent that Serfling believed that he did, Fifth Third Bank foreclosed on the property just prior to the closing, so Serfling certainly had no interest in the property at the time that the loan closed in April of 2002, but that he obtained the property as a result of the loan closing. So much so that he called himself the new owner. He found a caretaker for the property to whom he gave permission and the keys to take care of the property, and therefore he obtained an ownership interest in that property such that he received property that was valued in excess of $1 million. If I could just briefly touch on claim two with the reference to the gambling debt at trial. As a preliminary matter, the government would like to point out that this claim is reviewed for plain error. It is true that the defendant objected to the gambling reference at trial. There was a sidebar, and the court sustained the objection, but the defense never asked for a mistrial. So it's just like to first make clear that this claim should be reviewed for plain error. In terms of an explanation of what happened, on the first day of trial, pages 4 through 11 of the trial transcript, the court The district court below allowed evidence of this $4,800 debt that Mr. Serfling owed to Rampart's casino as motive evidence to defraud Western United. In other words, that he had debts to pay and therefore he had a reason in which to participate in the fraud. A few days later, when the actual witness on behalf of Rampart's casino made a reference to the gambling debt during her testimony, the government explained at sidebar that it misunderstood the court's ruling from before, essentially that it thought that what the court had allowed it to do was to get into the nature of the debt itself, that Serfling had a $4,800 debt, and that as soon as he got this $200,000 in loan proceeds, he went out and spent it, some of which was spent towards the repaying this $4,800 debt. The court at the sidebar, that's transcript page 676, disagreed that its ruling went that far and sustained the objection. As a footnote to these two, to that point, I would just add that the court twice instructed the jury to disregard the statement and that it could not be considered as evidence. And under Darden, the most important factor to weigh is, or to consider, is the weight of the evidence overall. And the government submits that the weight of the evidence in this case unquestionably showed Mr. Serfling's participation in the scheme to defraud, and that the comment in and of itself would not have prejudiced Mr. Serfling. In terms of the expert testimony, which is claim number 3, the government would simply rest on its brief but reiterate that this court has repeatedly held that evidence of whether or not the victim acted prudently or reasonably or even negligently simply is improper evidence at trial. And last but not least, with respect to claim 4, in terms of the amount of the loss, the guideline calculations as well as this court's decision in Lane make it clear that a loss calculation is to be determined by taking the amount of the loss, in this case approximately $11.75 million, and reducing that amount by the amount at which the victim recovered. In this case, it was $5 million. That leaves Western United with a $6.75 million loss, and therefore that was the correct restitution amount, and that number falls comfortably within the $2.5 million to $7 million loss range, and therefore there was appropriately, I believe it's an 18-month or an 18-point enhancement to his sentence. If there are no further questions, government rests on its briefs. Thank you.
Very briefly, just to correct a few things. First, Serfling had an interest in the property, and it was testified to by his lawyer, Ungaretti, at pages 6 and 7 of our brief, that he did have an interest in the property, both before and after the loan, and he went to the property after the loan to get keys. But there's no question that there is evidence that they claim is not in the brief, but look at pages 6 and 7. On the gambling aspect, there was a motion in limine on this. It wasn't just the fact that they came forward with the evidence the government did. It was prior to trial that they shouldn't bring in the gambling. There's no question they knew they shouldn't bring in the gambling, but they did.
I read that the transcript of the motion of the hearing on the motion in limine, and the government's confusion as to what had to be sanitized and what could be let in, I think, was somewhat justifiable.
You have to.
It wasn't entirely unjustified. Let's put it that way.
You have to be in the practice a few years, I respectfully submit, to know exactly what they sought to do, that he was a gambler, and they wanted it in. I wanted it out. That's why I said motion in limine to be out. Once it's in, the jury has it, and they get what they want on it. The evidence that we put in was that Serfling certainly knew about the loan, but not that it was secured through fraud of Capri. For instance, the loan, the Ford lease, went to Capri. She took the position of the woman at Ford, and it was her number. And the theory is it was Capri and Fifth Third Bank. Now, the evidence also established that Fifth Third Bank was not just a silent observer here. Their hideous loss they were trying to get across was thrust forward by Koenig, who was the lawyer who they pushed the closing of the loan. Serfling sought to stop the closing of the loan in the evidence that we've outlined, but then assented to it. They paid him $200,000. Now, if he's going to be whacked in this case, it ought to be for $200,000, not for $6.5 million. My time is up. Sorry.
No, your time isn't up. Even if you wanted to be Mr. Hart.
Oh, that's right. Well, my eyes are getting bad.
Mine too.
I know how it is.
You were all growing old together. It's kind of comforting, isn't it?
Right. I know, it is comforting.
In any event, everything we've stated is in the briefs, but he didn't get a fair shot at this, and he ought to get something. The biggest thing is the initial.
Didn't he put the whole $11+ million at stake by taking out a fraudulent loan that he knew he could not repay?
Your Honor, the evidence of the government was that the property was worth $11.5 million from Schmidt. The property, very valuable property in Gurnee. There's no question about it.
But the loss calculation comes from the amount that a defendant places at risk, not the amount that a defendant gains. That's United States versus Swanson.
Your Honor, the value of the property, $11.5 million, uncontradicted and put in by the government. Thank you.
Thank you. Peace. Thank you, Mr. Hart. Mr. Hart, you were asked to do this, weren't you? You were appointed.
Pro bono.
Pro bono. Well, we want to thank you for your vigorous, as always, defense of your client.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks to the government, too, of course. All right. The case will be taken under advisement. We will.